Hey, this is Andrew, and I'm walking around the campus of Loyola University. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Enjoy the beautiful campus of Loyola University up in Rogers Park. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. Great to be here with you today. This is show number 849. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is the engineer on duty in the WGN radio studios today. So good morning to Fergie. And again, happy that you are here joining the show today. So, okay, you heard Andrew. He was up there. Loyola, an institution of higher learning, higher education. I'm a high school teacher. I teach history and sociology. And one thing that we're talking about right now that honestly is a little terrifying is AI, artificial intelligence. Have you heard of this? ChatGPT. This site, ChatGPT, features some kind of artificial intelligence on the other end. And basically what you do is you can type in a prompt, you can type in a question for the AI to answer, and this program scours the internet for everything that was ever put out about whatever question that you are asking, and it writes a response. It writes a narrative. So as an educator, I'm thinking to myself, and so are a lot of other teachers, by the way, oh my goodness, now instead of students trying to plagiarize, they're going to type in a prompt into this ChatGPT thing, and ChatGPT is basically going to write papers for them, which is a real possibility. Now, the responses that ChatGPT gives aren't always completely accurate, and sometimes they're a little flimsy, but I thought I would give it a shot here. So I went to ChatGPT, and I typed in, write an introduction for my Chicago-centric radio show and podcast. So if I had to script an intro, which I never do, this is what ChatGPT wrote for me in like 10 seconds. This is what it says. It says, welcome to the Windy City Chronicles. There we go. Your destination for all things Chicago. Join us every weekday as we explore the rich history, vibrant culture, and diverse communities that make Chicago one of the most iconic cities in the world. From interviews with local business owners and community leaders to in-depth discussions on the city's politics and sports scene, the Windy City Chronicles has something for everyone. So tune in and join us as we discover the many stories that make Chicago one of the most fascinating places on earth. That's kind of terrifying. I mean, it's not bad. I don't do a ton of sports on this show, but everything else, I mean, I could tweak that and I could make that into a script if I scripted this thing. That's scary. However, the antidote to this could be this other program called GPT-0.me. It was developed by this 20-something-year-old, and it detects the use of AI. So I ran this intro thing that the AI spit out, and it says, the response here, this GPT-0 says, your text is most likely to be AI-generated. So it caught it. So I don't know here. The machines are taking over. Terminator was right. Hopefully not all the way. But now we've got artificial intelligence writing our papers, writing scripts. I'll have you know, though, that there is a live human being on this end of the microphone that is yours truly. And I love you for listening. We have a great show for you today. The Secret History of Chicago music segment, we will learn about a blues drummer who is also a vocalist and who is also female. That combination, not the most common. And the commissioner of the Chicago Public Library System will be with us to talk about 150 years of the Chicago Public Library. Stay tuned. It's great to be a real human being. Well, 2023 is underway, and this year marks the 150th anniversary of an important local institution, the Chicago Public Library. This library system features 81 locations across the city, making it one of the world's largest. And with us today to talk about 150 years of the Chicago Public Library is Library Commissioner Chris Brown. He came to the Chicago Public Library system in 2021 after more than 10 years in California. And I'm sure, Commissioner Brown, that the weather is totally on par with California here in Chicago.
Well, I gave up the weather, but came over here for a world-class, internationally leading library. So I definitely feel like the winner here.
Well, absolutely. And thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it. So this is so cool. 150 years of the Chicago Public Library. And I think it's worth mentioning at the outset here some of the history, because libraries, I think sometimes we take for granted. And, oh, yeah, it's the neighborhood library. It's just kind of there. It's always been there. But the history here, this is incredible. The Chicago Public Library got started in 1873. As I understand it, it was in a water tank that survived the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. Is that true?
That's true, yeah. And our first library collection actually was a donation of 8,000 books from Queen Victoria from the UK. They heard about the fire and they said, we got to help Chicago Public Library recover. They didn't realize that we didn't yet have a city library, but that civic investment is something that's at our origin story, and you can really see it throughout our history. Our city leaders, our aldermen, our communities, how they've continued to invest in our libraries to the point now where, as you mentioned, we have these 81 locations, this walkable access throughout our 77 neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to look at some of that history, how the Chicago Public Library system has really been a constant throughout the history of Chicago. And yeah, maybe it looked different, but these reading rooms, as they were sometimes called, in these different neighborhoods, people always, it seems, have been attracted to libraries in Chicago.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's the access, the presence in our neighborhoods, but then also the way that we offer something for every age. We're the largest provider of early literacy programming in Chicago, the largest provider of free broadband, a after-school space. We're renowned for our U-Media programming. Those are youth hangout spaces where kids can learn digital skill building. They can learn music production in 29 locations. And so we're really proud of the way that we serve all of Chicago in every neighborhood, and that we're such a beloved institution with 4.2 million visitors just this past year. Yeah. We lent our material over 12 million times. And it's really a story of this great civic institution that I think we can take a lot of pride in.
You know, you mentioned it there about some of those statistics, but the importance of these libraries. I mean, for so long, we grow up and we think about the library as a place where there are a lot of books, and certainly that is the case. But you mentioned computers, the broadband access now with technology, and especially having youth have access to that technology. Libraries are incredibly important because, at least the way I see it, it's more of like a community focal point in addition to a repository of knowledge. But this is really all about community, isn't it?
Absolutely. And our libraries really have evolved from those reading rooms you mentioned earlier into neighborhood connectors. And we're not just a place for books. We mentioned broadband. We mentioned out-of-school time programming for youth. But we're also a place for community rooms, for early voting. We have many of our libraries where people actually come in to vote. I think there's also this digital content that we're all becoming more versed with. So we have ebooks, we have databases, and we've really been not only a leader in providing services in Chicago, but also a leader nationally and internationally. So just recently in 2019, we became the largest big city library to go find free in the country. Mayor Lightfoot also supported us adding Sunday hours in the midst of the pandemic because we knew how important those digital access points were to our city. And so we've really shown that we're a world-class, not, of course, we're a world-class city, but our Chicago Public Library reflects that pride and that leadership we have throughout the country.
One thing that's important to keep in mind here is, okay, we've got these 81 locations across the city of Chicago. Now, we know historically that not every neighborhood in Chicago has received the same sort of investment, and there are disparities that exist across the cities. So when we apply that, we think about the library system, which is, you know, supposed to be open to everyone. Let's talk about equity there in terms of thinking about all Chicago neighborhoods and how they are served. Take us into your thought here about how libraries are playing into that and how we allocate resources. What's the conversation like around libraries and this issue of equity and having everyone a chance to have access to resources across the city of Chicago?
Well, I think you're bringing up an important point that libraries play this role as an equity driver, providing opportunity for everyone, every age, every neighborhood. And I think that was really why we made this effort to remove late fees, why we made this effort to add Sunday hours. Mm-hmm. The city's also made a significant investment over the past 2 years in its library collection. Our collection budget has increased 30%, which means that we've been able to purchase more in-demand material. Chicagoans request over 500,000 items be sent throughout the city to their local branch library every year.
Wow.
And because of that budget increase, we've been able to reduce the wait time for the most popular material by a full week. We've been able to refresh children's collections in 20 locations on the west and south side. And then also add a new senior equity officer who's going to be leading an assessment in 2023. So we'll be celebrating our history and also looking forward to decide how are we going to become a more equitable Chicago Public Library.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of those celebrations here and what you're up to now that we are in this 150th anniversary of the Chicago Public Library. It's a huge library system, and I think about growing up, you know, maybe a school library or your local small-ish branch library, and you know, it's a lot to run one building, but here we are with now 81 locations across the city. What are some of the biggest challenges that you have running a library system that's this size? What's that like?
It's our biggest challenges are also our biggest opportunities. It's continuing to refresh those spaces, make sure that they're inspiring and up to date, that when kids walk into them, when families walk into them, they realize this is a space they want to stay in and be in often. And we've just been thrilled how we've been able to work with the Chicago Housing Authority to implement industry-leading models where we've co-located libraries with affordable housing. So the folks who have some of the highest levels of need in our city are now put into closest proximity with broadband, with city services, with early literacy programs. And the newest example of that is our Altgeld library in Altgeld Gardens, which is not only co-located, but it's co-located with a child care center. So thinking about who's co-located with those facilities and how we can better serve them. And of course, libraries are big in the role of our kids' lives in early literacy. And this new facility is just sort of a intuitive match between libraries and child care services.
And it's interesting, I think, that how we've been talking about the evolution of libraries here. So, yes, a repository of knowledge and books and information to technology now, to meeting spaces, to now helping out with those who are having housing challenges and childcare. And I mean, it's really amazing when you think about it. These places have all of this, you know, under one roof. And, I've lived in different areas of Chicago, and I think one constant is the local library. And I think it's worth mentioning here that over the years, it's kind of the will of the people. I mean, people keep coming to these libraries, and that might sound like, well, no kidding. But really, I mean, if people weren't showing up, then there might not be as much of a, you know, a push or an interest in this stuff. But it's the people, it's the residents of Chicago that support their local branches. And it's really an outpouring of love and support. And so I think it's worth calling this out, that people are clamoring for this stuff, aren't they?
They are. And not every city, not every county, not every municipality has, I think, the support that the Chicago Public Library does. Our city leaders, our aldermen, our neighborhood leaders and community-based groups, there is so much support for our Chicago Public Library. So many instances where neighborhood groups and our city leaders have led the development of new libraries in their wards. And so I think it's a story and a history that we can all be proud of. So that's from grassroots-led, resident-led library innovations, all the way to mayors like Harold Washington helping to move forward the building of our Harold Washington Library Center, which is the largest central library in the U.S.
That's beautiful.
Again to Mayor Lightfoot today and going fine free and adding Sunday hours to Cindy Pritzker establishing our library foundation. It's really a story of civic engagement that's at the heart of our Chicago Public Library story.
So, all right, let's talk about this special year, because 1873, 150 years ago, the Chicago Public Library officially starts. And this year, I know that you and the folks at the Chicago Public Library are planning a bunch of events. So, I mean, this is going to go on through the whole year, but really this is kind of a celebration of really everything that we've been talking about here. Community, culture, the access to information and equity. And this is a year that you are going to do. You've planned a bunch of celebratory activities, haven't you?
Absolutely. And everyone loves a birthday party. And so in every one of our 81 libraries all throughout our city, we're going to be convening families and communities to celebrate the investments their local neighborhoods have made and the access to information and inspiration and reading that we stand for. And it's not just going to be at, you know, one point in the year. It's going to be all throughout 2023. So those birthday parties will be in June. Before then, in March, we're going to be having exhibits in 10 historic buildings. We have many historic, gorgeous facilities represented in our 81 locations. So we'll have a chance for communities to walk through 10 of those most historic locations, like our Blackstone location in Hyde Park, all the way to, in the summer, the launch of our first podcast series that will be done in partnership with the award-winning PRX podcast entity. And we'll have a chance to really tell some of these incredible stories that are at the heart of our city library. Like I mentioned, our U-Media programming earlier, and we've just had so many notable Chicagoans who have gone through that program, like Chance the Rapper. That was where he would hold open mic nights, where he would do recording sessions to No Name and Saba and these really incredible MCs in our city that we boast, all who kind of came through our U-Media program. So it's going to really be a chance for us to tell so many of those stories that people just may not have realized the impactful role our Chicago Public Library has played.
So, Commissioner, let me ask you this, because before I let you go here, I have to ask this. So you and I have been talking about a lot of the positives, right, of the library system here. But across the country, you know, libraries are facing some real challenges and things like censorship and, you know, restricting books and things like that. And of course, with funding, because it does take a commitment, it does take a will to keep the funding steady and constant to make these places really unique and powerful and anchors of the community. And we're lucky here in Chicago, but not every municipality across the country is that lucky. So as you kind of take a step back here and look at the landscape, what's the future of libraries here? Are libraries in danger? What's that outlook, do you think?
I'm glad you asked about that. I think anyone who's watching the news and reading about the book bans that are going on, it is a concerning time around our freedom of expression, our freedom to represent our diversity, our many different stories. And I think as one of the most diverse cities in the country, Chicago prides itself on the diversity of our city and the different backgrounds represented in just this incredible place that we call home. And so this year, we launched a book sanctuary campaign, this idea of designating all of our libraries as sanctuaries for diverse stories, to be a model and to provide a path forward for the rest of the country in upholding our freedom to read. And so we have our taglines that some books have heroes, other books need heroes. And we're asking everyone to join what we're calling the Readsistance and to go to thebooksanctuary.org to sign up and designate their book sanctuaries. And it doesn't always need to be a library. It could be someone's home library. It could be a school. It could be a coffee shop. But to sign up and to add to this visible dialogue about the importance of our freedoms.
Yeah, I mean, we are living in quite the time right now. And again, like I said, I think we're lucky. I think we're lucky to be here to have access to this system, the Chicago Public Library System. Again, 81 locations across the city. It's one of the world's largest library system. And in 2023, the Chicago Public Library is celebrating 150 years. We can, of course, check out the website, chipublib.org, chipublib, I guess you would say, .org. And Commissioner Chris Brown of the Chicago Public Library, it's great to talk to you. Congratulations on this 150 years. And I know that this is just kind of the beginning. We're kicking off a celebratory year here, but really what you're doing for so many people and everyone who works in these branches and you know, in some cases volunteers their time, it's a great service to our community. So thank you for all of your work and congratulations and best of luck going forward.
Thank you. And thanks for helping us tell our story.
In the Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Well, it's early in the morning and it's cold. It's so cold. Just sitting here thinking.
Oh, yes. Once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader. He is also known as Plastic Crime Wave. And we are in the winter blues. And Steve, this week, this is a remarkable story here because, okay, we've got a blues artist here. It's a female blues artist. That's remarkable. But a female blues artist who is both a vocalist and a drummer? That never happens.
I know. I really wanted to tell her story. Kind of gets pushed aside, and I used a bunch of different sources to try and sort of piece it together. Because, sadly, just not spoken of enough. She was kind of a trailblazer.
That's right. We are talking about one Johnny Mae Dunson. Johnny Mae Dunson. She is something special. She is just a no-nonsense, and you write about this in your piece. You can just tell by listening to her. I mean, she's not taking anything from anyone. She's no-nonsense, and she kind of does things her own way. She's raw, but that is exactly who we should be thinking about in the secret history of Chicago music, right?
Definitely. And you know, I mean, it's sad women get sort of pushed aside, you know, in history in general, and then in music history even more, and then in blues history and in the blues in general. It's just there's not that many, sadly. You know, it's a very sort of male-dominated form, and, you know, she just, yeah, broke all the rules from the beginning. They you know, and even I had a quote from another sort of female blues woman in there, Catherine Davis, who was just like, you know, I knew that these kind of artists existed, but I just didn't hear about them, you know? So yeah. It's like, this is when I like, okay, this is my duty to come in and expose this like talent, personality, and just, you know, not someone even trying to break any rules, just did it, you know, wasn't trying to change the form, just followed her own path, and pretty clear from the beginning.
Johnny Mae Dunson is who we are talking about here, blues vocalist and drummer. She is born in Alabama in 1921, and from the get-go, I mean, at age two, she contracts rheumatic fever, which really weakened her heart. And it was a miracle that she survived. And a lot of people told her during her early years that she wouldn't survive.
Yeah. I mean, they basically told her she was going to die. You know, I mean, they were basically having like, you know, the preacher come in and say prayers over her and stuff. But, you know, she's clearly been a tough cookie from like day one, and just like, beat it, you know, like just not only beat it, was you know, a vital person, you know.
So she is going to leave school early on because of her heart condition, because her heart was weakened because of this rheumatic fever that she contracted when she was two. So she's basically leaving school at 10. After that, she's around the house, and this is when she starts to kind of get into the drums a little bit, when she's thumping on a wash tub.
Yeah, I guess it was a thing to sort of take the tub down to the stream to get fresh water. You know, I mean, she came from, you know, pretty poor conditions. And so she would sort of like bribe her sister to let her take the tub so that she could, yeah, thump on it and sort of like start getting it down, you know, start getting down rhythmically how to drum a bit. And then hearing a little bit on records, like she also at the same time her grandmother had a Victrola, you know, and had records by sort of like, you know, the few legendary ladies of the blues, Bessie Smith, Memphis Minnie, Ma Rainey. So she was kind of hearing that stuff at the same time, and you know, she describes herself as a self-taught musician, and she definitely is.
Yeah, self-taught drummer. I love that she was thumping on the washtub. That is wonderful. And she, in 1943, is encouraged by some visiting women from Chicago who heard her sing. They encouraged her to move to Chicago. And this kind of gets her on the path to Maxwell Street.
Yeah. I mean, we just covered an artist who, another one who kind of got their start going to John Primer, who started going to Maxwell Street, too. It was just such an important mecca, you know, of like immigrants and musicians and just everything going on there. And yeah, she basically got to sit down on this fellow's kit, who I saw his name. It was either Eddie Porkchop Hines or Porkchops. Some people just called him Porkchops Hines. And he was like, you know, she said he looked tired or something. So she was like, can I sit on your kit? And he was like, all right, you know, don't get too used to this. And he's like, oh, you should never leave. Because once he heard her play, he was like, oh, damn. So it's like, you know, things, magical things like that could happen. And she started her first group basically off of that, you know, called the Globetrotters, which was a lounge sort of on this strip on the west side along Madison Street, where it sounds like there were all these cool clubs in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And she, for the next 30 years, I mean, she's basically playing gigs on the west side and on the south side of Chicago. She's playing with everybody. I mean, it's again, one of these things where all these great blues people can talk about her because they've played with her. She basically gets to be very friendly with Jimmy Reed, the great harmonica player, Jimmy Reed. They become friends, and she's writing for him and managing for him for a little bit. And they put out some music together.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other kind of amazing thing is she was this incredible, prolific writer, too, on, you know, on top of, like, sort of owning this, you know, gut bucket style blues that women didn't really do very much. She also was this great songwriter. And yeah, she was given songs to Jimmy Reed. She gave a song to Muddy Waters, you know, and supposedly she carried around like a big sort of binder or book of like all these songs and just had hundreds of songs on top of it. So she might have been some kind of genius, you know, like or just savant, you know, basically doing this stuff. But yeah, I mean, she really didn't put out much music. So these 45 she did as a duo with Jimmy Reed, and these some of his singles are some of the only stuff she's really on, sadly.
I made the clouds come out. I made the sun go down. Now, wasn't that a woman? I'm just a whole lot of woman.
In this case, it's hard to find her music. So we know that she's prolific in the sense that she was playing with a lot of people over the years all over Chicago. But in terms of recorded music, that is harder to find. And you've talked about how blues folks are just obsessive about cataloging and finding recordings. But this is hard to find her music. And the music that we are hearing today, it's not her on the drums. She's basically just singing. So we can't really find anything with her on the drums.
Yeah, well, you know, so she basically disappeared in the 70s. She totally kind of left, you know, basically got into real estate and would, you know, supposedly go to town on a you know, wall with a sledgehammer herself, rehabbing a building and stuff like that. Because, again, nobody messed with her. And, yeah, she got rediscovered in the 90s. And then, yeah, she didn't record her first real album, definitely under her own name, until 2000. And that's what you're basically hearing is her singing. And, you know, she's got, like, a stable of musicians backing her on that. But yeah, so it really took off. And I find that with a lot of these blues artists, you know, until like sort of CDs came around and it was a little easier to get recordings out in the 90s and aughts, early aughts, you know, a lot of them didn't, who were sort of these marginal figures or sidemen. They didn't really get their albums out until that time, usually.
So she's rediscovered in the 90s, and then, like you say, in the 2000s, in 2000, she releases her first and only album under her own name. And unfortunately, so she kind of, from what you write here, I mean, she has a lot of stuff in her house. She accumulates a lot of things. She just, as she gets older, she doesn't go to a lot of places. And her house is kind of like this museum when it comes time for her to move out. There's a lot of stuff that's left behind there.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, so this old blues musician, Jimmy Lee Robinson, who I actually covered for the strip a long time ago, very, very legendary guy, he found her. She was mad at him over some misunderstanding. They cleared it up. He tried to kind of bring her back, and he did. He got her to come down to Maxwell Street and what was left of it and sort of perform a like a benefit. So that was basically the quote unquote rediscovery. But when he found her, she had not left the house in 10 years.
Wow.
She had not left the house in 10 years. She was basically in a wheelchair and the house, I guess, was just like basically falling apart. So sadly, the city basically condemned it and would not let her back into it. They didn't knock it down, but they were like, "You, this isn't safe, you know, so you can't occupy this space." So that blues vocalist I mentioned, Catherine Davis, actually took her in for a while there. But yeah, I think sadly she had a house fire at one point too, where she lost all her songs.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was just all on paper, you know. Yeah. So, you know, it's definitely a bit of tragedy in her life, you know. But she kind of was like getting rediscovered, you know, towards the end of her career. She did play some Chicago blues fests and such, but she passed in 2007. So she, you know, she had just sort of come back for, you know, a bit, and you know, burned out.
Yeah. Well, Johnny Mae Dunson is who we're talking about, and she spent most of her years here in Chicago, and she was a vocalist, a drummer. Again, that is just a unique combination as a female in the blues, and her voice is great. She is so talented, playing with so many people, and you can get the whole story when you check out The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is a strip in the Chicago Reader. It's online as well, chicagoreader.com. And Steve Krakow, our good friend, is the author of that strip. He also hand draws, the portrait of whoever he's profiling and who we're talking about. In this case, Johnny Mae Dunson. So you could check that out as well. Hey, Steve, as always, sir, I appreciate it. We are in the winter blues, even though it was like 50 degrees earlier in the week, but that's okay. We've got Johnny Mae Dunson's tunes to keep us company, so thank you as always, sir.
Yep, and if anyone out there's got the rare lost Johnny Mae recordings, get in touch.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 849 is all wrapped up. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I love you for listening. I love Bob Ferguson. He's the engineer. He makes us sound really nice. So that's great. Thanks to Fergie. Have a fantastic, wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.